Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of March 31st, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. D.R., I have been, this is, again, a week of an onslaught of news of all kinds from the highest levels of the federal government. This week, though, for Climate Hawk, something in particular came down that was needs to be discussed and processed, and that's what we're all about. We're all about processing what we hear and trying to figure out what we think about it. So this week, the President of the United States signed a document that basically tried to reverse the advances that President Obama had tried to make against climate change. So tell me, DR, can you fill me in on what the new guy signed?
Yes, there are several basic components of the Trump so-called energy independence executive order. Number one, it calls for, at the very least, a weakening, an attempt to weaken the Clean Power Plan. There's still, you know, thanks to Massachusetts versus EPA, the 2007 ruling that said that the federal government had a duty to regulate CO2, and thanks to a subsequent endangerment finding that recognized CO2 as a risk, it is still federal law that the government has to have some plan to regulate CO2. But the effort on the part of Trump is to essentially begin the process of weakening any sort of effort to regulate CO2 from power plants. He wants to sort of weaken carbon standards for new coal power plants in addition to currently existing coal-fired power plants. He wants to weaken regulations on methane emissions from oil and gas operations. He wants to weaken the what's known as the social cost of carbon estimate that's used to sort of assess the climate risks of new projects undertaken by the government. He wants to lift the moratorium on federal coal leasing, and already that has been subject to a legal challenge. And he wants to wipe out the guidance for factoring climate change into reviews under the 1969 National Environmental Policy Act. Those are the main takeaways from this fairly grim executive order.
All right, so we got to unpack that. There's a lot there. Let's go back. And probably the thing that people hear most about is how the new president is trying to, quote unquote, repeal Obama's Clean Power Plan. And DR, as you just said, the Clean Power Plan is justified because the courts, it's not justified, it's required because the courts ordered the EPA to declare whether or not carbon was a dangerous thing, and they did that, so now they're obligated to regulate it. This guy wants to basically reconsider that. But what does it mean for the EPA to have to reconsider the Clean Power Plan? They would have to present new science, right, to refute the old science. Isn't that how it goes?
Well, according to Dan Farber of Legal Planet, he notes, quote, EPA will need to begin a new rulemaking process to essentially weaken the Clean Power Plan. It could argue that a drafting glitch eliminates its authority to address this issue at all, which the courts might not embrace. It could argue that it could only engage in minor tinkering of operations at individual fossil fuel plants, or it could fine-tune the rules to reduce the burdens on individual states. Farber also notes, and it has subsequently come out, that Attorney General Jeff Sessions has asked the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to basically hold off on making a decision upholding or rejecting the Clean Power Plan while they decide how to sort of water down the Clean Power Plan.
But I think you said something important there, and that we got to make clear. They have the EPA under this executive order has to begin a new rulemaking process. And what that means is that they have to now engage in a process of presenting science that reverses the old ruling that came under Obama. Then they have to have public hearings on it, And then there's a long period where they review the public input, and then they have to put out a second revision. And finally, after another long period of public input, it becomes a new quote-unquote rule, right, which is basically an interpretation of the law, how we're going to do the law, right? So that's what they got to start doing now. And it's not clear that that's really – it's certainly not quick. It's certainly not like Mr. Orangehead can sign a piece of paper and all of a sudden the Obama plan's gone away. All he's done is to give permission to begin a long and arduous process, right?
Exactly, exactly. And once that new – once the new, weaker version of the Clean Power Plan is formulated, that will be subject to inevitable legal challenges.
Right, right. And every step of the way, there's going to be people jumping in and trying to stop them. And, of course, the Clean Power Plan rule that the Obama administration put out, the reason it was so hard to do is because it talked about what are called existing sources. That is to say, coal plants that are already built. And those are, you know, there's a lot of money tied up in those. And so changing those are a tough way to go. So so there's that. Then the other interesting thing is that they talked about this idea of the social cost of carbon. I think that bears a little bit of discussion as well. So is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, DR, is the social cost of carbon is basically a dollar value that is put on a ton of carbon dioxide, and that dollar value is supposed to represent, if money can, right, it's supposed to represent the social damage to people's lives, to their health, to the environment. All that gets rolled up into a dollar sign, and that's the social cost of carbon, right?
Yes, that's correct. And Brad Plumer of Vox noted that 10 years ago, a federal district judge ordered the Department of Transportation to formulate what we now call a social cost of carbon. They have to take climate change into account when weighing the cost and benefits of new regulations. Based on that 2007 ruling, the Obama administration basically tried to formulate what we now call an official social cost of carbon. Mr. Plumer notes, quote, the Trump administration will now explore ways to redo and possibly lower the social cost of carbon estimate, though again, they may face court challenges. One route they may take is to take into account only the damages that climate change causes the United States. But as Plumer notes, the National Academy of Sciences disagrees with this approach, and many experts say the social cost of carbon should be higher, not lower.
Right. And the reason that the social cost of carbon, that's in quotation marks, right? Sort of like wiretapping and the social cost of carbon, that's important because that is the dollar amount that gets folded into the cost-benefit analysis of any new policy. So if Mr. The guy in charge wants to open up a new power plant, the social cost of those emissions has to be included on the negative side of the ledger, the cost of building that power plant, right? And that happens with all these federal rules. So what Trump wants to do is to make the social cost of carbon lower and lower and basically make that estimate, turn that estimate down to a lower number. I think right now the dollar value of the social cost of carbon, I think, is $40 a ton. Does that ring a bell to you, DR? I can't say for sure, but it's something like that.
And it's somewhere around about $36
per ton. But I mean, just to put that in people's head, I mean, this is a real number. It's $36 per ton. So if the Trump they want to drive that down to $5 a ton, right, through magic of, you know, estimating and all the kind of stuff that they can do behind closed doors, they want to make the estimate that that's lower, and that for justifies much more carbon pollution because the cost is lower. So anyway, so he's trying to reduce that, but it's not going to be easy, right? That's now, from my perspective, it's cold comfort for us to be talking about how difficult it's going to be for the administration to destroy all of Obama's good stuff. But I mean, that's right now, that's the bright side of the silver lining of the cloud, right? Is that Trump says he's going to sign a paper doing all these things, but in fact, it's much harder than he knows. Now, on the plus side, I think you made reference to it before, but there are two things that are on the plus side in this executive order. One is that there's no mention of the Paris Climate Accord, right?
There is no mention of the Paris Climate Accord, although Jim Browdy of the NPR News affiliate here in Boston, WGBH, has noted that the cumulative effect of this executive order may be to, in effect, pull the United States out of Paris without officially doing so. And that may have been the calculation by Trump and his minions, that if you effectively, you know, make the United States' commitments in Paris null and void, you have, for all intents and purposes, pulled the country out of the Paris Agreement.
But they must be feeling some heat on so the Trump administration must be feeling some heat that it's better for them to appear to stay in it. So the Paris Accord is this international agreement of many countries that have all promised to reduce their carbon pollution. They promised. And so as the United States could either not fulfill its promises or lower its promises or something, or it could actively pull out to try and destroy the fragile agreement. And it hasn't chosen to do that second thing, which can only be a good thing, because maybe when Trump gets impeached, Mike Pence will have a change of heart and decide that we really ought to have carbon tax or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other good thing about this executive order, to the extent there's anything good about it, is that it did not explicitly tell the EPA to try to reverse what's called this endangerment finding. Again, something in quotation marks, but the endangerment finding is the legal conclusion that the EPA came to, saying that carbon dioxide is in fact a pollutant and dangerous, it endangers health and safety, right? Mm-hmm. That's a sacrosanct thing, because that justifies everything else, right?
And that was the most fascinating aspect of this, because Politico reported that it was actually, of all people, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt who advised the Trump administration not to challenge the endangerment finding, arguing that there's essentially no court in this country that would, you know, buy into the sort of arguments you would have to make in order for that endangerment finding to be invalidated. And, you know, Pruitt would essentially have to literally try to convince a court that global warming was a hoax in order to have that endangerment finding invalidated. And Pruitt may be an ideologue, but he's not stupid enough to do that. And as a result of Pruitt's advice to not touch the endangerment finding, he's getting heat from even more extreme deniers, you know, the Heartland Institute crowd that essentially wants him gone, because they regard him as a rhino now and a squish, because he won't, you know, go into court and say that, you know, carbon pollution isn't a threat.
Oh my God. Well, so there's a few ins and outs of the executive order itself. One of the things that I've heard said, maybe you can confirm or deny this, DR, but the much of the Trumpian bombast has been around bringing back coal jobs in the coal country. But I mean, it's pretty clear that this executive order is not going to have much impact on jobs in coal country. Would you agree with that?
It's going to have virtually no impact at all. Even so, I believe Robert Murray of Murray Energy was one of the individuals who basically said it's not going to, you know, resurrect the coal industry. That what is, you know, that the real war on coal was launched by automation and the fracking industry, not by anything Obama did. So it does raise the question of when the people in coal country who voted for Trump realize that those coal jobs are not coming back, are they going to turn on him? And if so, you know, what does that say about his prospects to remain in the White House, basically?
Yeah, I guess I'm cynical enough to think that they never, the fact of the matter is, no matter what anybody thinks about it, it's unlikely that there's going to be lots and lots of people going down into the ground to dig coal anymore. It just doesn't work that way. But I guess, you know, light years away from the poor coal miner who does a dangerous job in a dangerous circumstance, there's a guy named Jeffrey Immelt, I think, who is head of General Electric. Now, General Electric is... you've seen their ads on TV for many years, although I think I haven't seen that many lately. But anyway, oh yeah, they're GE still on. They're big time on TV, right? Because they're now into coding machine language stuff. Anyway, General Electric has recently set up their main corporate center in downtown Boston, believe it or not. And in fact, they're building their main corporate center in a place that's probably going to get flooded in 20 years, but we'll put that aside. The CEO of General Electric came out and said something about the wisdom of the president in this executive order, DR, right? What did he say?
Yes, Jeff Immelt declared, quote, "No matter how it unfolds, it doesn't change what GE believes. We believe climate change is real and the science is well accepted. Our customers, partners, and countries are demanding technologies that generate power while reducing emissions, improving energy efficiency, and reducing cost," unquote. And Think Progress also noted that companies such as Nike and Gap and AT&T and other major companies have also made it clear that they disagree with this effort to sort of gut to gut the clean power plan. Of course, that does go back to an issue that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island has raised, that there are a lot of companies that profess to be green and to profess to support climate action, but they won't actively lobby Congress to put a price on carbon, whereas the fossil fuel industry is still actively lobbying Congress not to put a price on carbon.
Yes,
so that creates
yes.
what Chris Hayes once called an asymmetry of intensity in terms of who is winning and who is losing this fight mm-hmm. on Capitol Hill.
I think you're right. I mean, it's how do you put pressure on Jeffrey Immelt to lobby harder? But it seems to me these big companies want a stable business conditions around energy. And mm-hmm. what the Trumpster is doing is so unhinged and so at odds with reality that if you're head of GE and you know you're going to be there in 20 years, or GE's going to be there in 20 years after Trump is long gone, I mean, you have to be thinking that somehow the inevitability of the climate issue coming back is still going to come back to haunt you after Trump is gone. And so that's why I think those guys would say they oppose what this executive order, because it just disrupts the business environment around something that around it, because everyone knows what direction the economy is going. It's towards cleaner mm-hmm. energy, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just that's almost inevitable. And these are only short-term delays that Trump is proposing. So a guy like Immelt at GE, he's got this huge behemoth under him. He knows that it's going to have to accommodate the rebound from Trump at some time in the future. So mm-hmm. that's why I think they're opposing it.
And these companies remember Sandy. They remember the economic damage that Sandy inflicted. You know, if you're the head of Amazon and you know that extreme weather is going to make it, you know, virtually impossible to deliver your packages, mm-hmm. aren't you going to, you know, on some level recognize that, hey, you know, we need to do something about this issue?
Yeah. Well, either that or they need to get drones that are able to fly through hurricanes so they can deliver.
Exactly.
Well, DR, I think that, look, we had a nice agenda, DR. We had a nice agenda of things we wanted to talk about with related to the this executive order. And, of course, we've only gotten through the first of them. So I mm-hmm. think what we should do is postpone to our next show a discussion about, you know, how to interpret all this. But let me just give you a taste of it, all right?
Mm-hmm.
My reaction and reaction of various opinion pieces I've read say that that this thing that Trump is doing is an opportunity to call for a really big and much more aggressive plan than what Obama wanted, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the clean power plan is great, but reality is it's a much bigger task. There are what you might call roadmaps out there that call for, you know, how do you actually reduce the carbon dioxide in a much more aggressive way? So when Trump collapses, right, mm-hmm. and he's impeached, you know, there'll be a plan around that's very aggressive. So we're going to come back to that. But let me just say the other thing is that April 29th is coming, right? So tomorrow is April Fool's Day. And here in Boston, we're going to have a whole lot of April Fool's Day snow on the ground from what I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
But April 29th is coming. And that is the day of the climate march down in D.C. And there are buses. We'll put up links to various buses. I just saw that Blue Mass Group, I guess, is running buses out of Boston. There are buses from distributed around different towns in the state. If you Google People's Climate March, you'll be able to search your way towards a bus no matter what part of the country you're in. So please plan to go. There are also going to be sister marches in different towns. So if you can't get to D.C., look to a march near your home. It's that sort of people in the street who then are motivated to vote in 2 years, but it's people on the street now that will impress your legislators, even if Donald Trump is able to is golfing in Mar-a-Lago while we're marching. The other thing to keep in mind is that on April 22nd, the week before the People's Climate March, there's going to be also a series of nationwide marches to support science, which is pretty much in the same wheelhouse as the People's March for Climate, but that's going to be happening in D.C. It's going to be happening in sister sites around the country. So here's a great opportunity to get out, put your body in the street to show that you care about this issue. I would urge you to do it. Right, D.R.?
Absolutely.
All right. So look, D.R., we got to put it down there. Let's tell everybody that we'll put up links to most of what we talked about. I think it's mostly what we whined and kvetched about in this show. But, I mean, the topics that were mentioned, we'll put in the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. Of course, we'll put a link on our Facebook page at /massclimateaction, which you can go through to get to the player. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio or Overcast or Podbean or SoundCloud, yada, yada, yada. Of course, you can find us on iTunes. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.